Accession number 14284, Reel 1.
Mr. Carling, Reel 1. I think you were in the famous Wavell Push in the desert at the end of 1940.
Ah, yes. We got into that unintentionally, you might say, because after the fall of France, the company I had joined originally, the 13th Troop Carrying Company in the Royal Army Service Corps, was no longer required. The people that we were going to carry were in the bag, and we were posted out to Egypt. The intention being...
From Egypt to Palestine, you think?
Yes. The intention being that we should form a transport link across from the Gulf, of the Persian Gulf, to the Mediterranean, and carry petrol, oil, and lubricants for the various forces in the Palestine area. There was quite a lot of trouble in Palestine at the time, you might remember. However, we hadn't really got very far on with that. We'd gotten our vehicles assembled in Habania, and we'd gotten them across to Haifa when it was made known that we were about to attack the Italians in Libya. And our company immediately set out in convoy and drove all the way over the Sinai through Alexandria and up to Mersa Matruh in the course of a couple of days. I had been the company office clerk in Palestine and travelled in the back of one of the trucks most of the way. But I had to relieve the sergeant on his motorcycle. He was keeping the convoy in order and keeping proper dispersal between vehicles and so on. I boobed at the end because when the convoy turned off the road eventually to go onto the desert just beyond Mersa Matruh, I waited until the last vehicle had gone over and then set out to follow them on the motorbike. It was an impossible task, I might tell you, and I was very lucky to be picked up just before sunset by a couple of Northumberland Fusiliers who happened to be going to the forward supply depot, which was our destination. Okay. The other thing which went wrong for us was something very similar to what had happened to us in Palestine. The rains caught us out. And the first place where we settled down in the Mersa Matruh area, it came down solid water again. We'd already had a sample of it at the foot of Mount Carmel, where we were under canvas in the initial stages of our visit to the Middle East, and we'd had some very bad flooding there. And, the same thing happened when we got to this wadi in Mersa Matruh. It poured and poured, and when we awoke in the morning, half the vehicles were up to their axles in mud. So we had a job pulling them out and getting ourselves organized. In time to sort of get into the full swing of things, the 7th Armored Division had already moved on through, and we were to follow them, supplying them with petrol, oil, and lubricants, and ammunition, of course. And we were very smartly got into line for that job and made for Saloum at the foot of Hellfire Pass. There we had to wait until the fort at the top, Badia, fell, and we stood by whilst the Navy shelled them, which turned out very interesting. The Navy had what was called a dreadnought lying off the coast there and was firing a 15-inch gun at the fortress at the top of the escarpment, and the size of the lumps of shrapnel that were coming off these 15-inch shells and were lying about the desert when we made our subsequent climb up to the top of the escarpment, surprised most of us, and had, of course, surprised the Italians in Badia even more. They gave up more or less straight away as soon as the shelling started, and we followed the Durhams up through Hellfire Pass with our petrol and went on ahead of the main force to put down a forward supply depot for the armour. Their advance was so quick that half the supplies that we put down were just left behind. They had to get on. So we were really in a hurry with a new lot of forward supply depots, more or less every couple of days. And we did, on some occasions, as far as a couple of hundred miles in convoy over the open country, which was some going, I might tell you. It put a terrific strain on the vehicles, of course, and even bigger strain on the blokes, most of whom were young conscripts in the 18 to 20s sort of group that Belisha had just enrolled. Fortunately, we had some hardened characters as well. And I look at the photograph of that particular company and look first of all at the really hardy blokes, old Sharman and Riley, ex-regulars, of course, men who had been all over the world in different frontiers, India, Hong Kong, trained people. And they formed the nucleus of this group, and the youngsters, well, what do you have to say? In the course of the next month or two, the boys became men, I might tell you. We were loading at night, we were driving all day, we were offloading at night. The work really was very, very tough. I considered myself fortunate, having got a stripe early on. I didn't really have quite a lot of manual work to do. We had a couple of air attacks, two, three air attacks, and lost a few vehicles, of course. Particularly bad for me, the vehicle in which my kit was travelling was set on fire, and I lost all my kit, of course, including my boots, because I was wearing shorts and sandals all the time when we were in the action. And I had to draw some Indian Army issue kit, and none of it fitted me, of course. More so than anything else, the boots were impossible. I had to cut them to get my feet into them. When I was called back to officers' training for an interview, and the brigadier took one look at me looking like nothing on earth and made some kind of a comment, to which I'm afraid I reacted rather badly, because he had just come up from some place like Alexandria and I had just come down from the outskirts of Benghazi, or El Agheilat was actually. So I was returned to unit, I'm afraid, and instead of being commissioned, I got another tape and got full corporal, paid corporal at long last. I'd been acting unpaid lance corporal for quite some time. I did 9 months on the desert before I had to leave. And I, of course, I drew 9 months back pay, which gave me a very extravagant 9 days in Cairo, I might tell you.
What were the delights of Cairo at that time?
The delights of Cairo?
Yes.
For me, it was a wonderful experience because I had traveled down with two South Africans who knew the ropes in Cairo more than most, obviously. And we were able to go into Shepherd's and places like that, although it was other ranks weren't supposed to do that. They didn't consider South African other ranks in the same way as they did the Tommies. So I was with two South Africans, and we were in the swimming pool at Shepherd's before they realized that they should have drawn the line a bit earlier. So we got chucked out of Shepherd's. That was one of the good things. The other thing they were able to offer, of course, was the South African Springbok Club, which compared to our NAFIC canteens was, you know, the Ritz. They also were able to introduce me to a couple of very nice South African, ATS types, who made the holiday for us, really. It was absolutely wonderful. We went to the belly dancing, of course, and all that kind of thing. And we had an awful lot of booze. The South Africans were allowed to buy spirits. We were not supposed to buy spirits. So I drank a lot of brandy with the South Africans on that leave. And I might say it changed my life very considerably, because until then I had been more or less Toc H, Boy Scouts, the choir. it was one of those sort of hardening experiences. Served me in good stead later, I might tell you. when I got back to the unit, we had a new colonel. And he and I didn't get on at all well. I had developed a bit of a limp because I'd had a bit of a lump on my leg, which had precluded me from joining the Air Force at the beginning of the war. And he made some kind of a remark about the way I was walking and said that I should go sick. So on the next leave I got, about 6 or 7 months later, I made contact with a friend who was working in the base offices and asked him how I should go about seeing a specialist about this leg. He put me on the right track. This chap took one look at me and said, "Well, there's nobody can do anything for you here, my son. You're going to have to go home." So I'm in Heliopolis Hospital before the leave was ended, and I didn't go back to my unit. I came home and had the best part of a year, I suppose, in hospital, whilst they chopped a lump off my leg. It turned out to be, it's called an osteochondroma. And I heard later that it weighed 3.5 pounds. So they had a hammer and chisel job to sort out. Gave me a lot of worry because it looked as though I was going to get chucked out the army. You know? I didn't want that. I didn't want to go back to work for Father. And anyhow, I preferred not to go back home. The Command Mixed Transport Company was the next effort I was connected with. I was posted to Catterick Camp and was a driving instructor there. Medical grade C, awaiting discharge. However, it was very obvious that the treatment I had had and the subsequent exercise and physiotherapy treatment at Dunblane Hydro had put my leg into very good order. In fact, when I went to see the MO with a view to getting posted elsewhere, he said, "What medical grade do you think you are then?" I said, "Well, I'm A1, of course I'm A1. Well, he said, "My job is really to stop people from trying to be grade D when they're grade B. If you want to be A1, give me a K paybook." So I gave him my paybook and he wrote in A1. I went back to the CO, the colonel. I said, "Look," he said, "I've been made A1. "Well," he said, "Carling, what do you want to do?" I said, "I want to get into airborne." There was a notice in the mess about the parachute regiment. "Oh," he said, "wait a minute. Didn't you volunteer for the Air Force at the beginning?" I said, "Oh, yes, I did." "Well," he said, "this is something you should have a shot at first off." And he showed me a circular which had come asking for contact to be made with anybody who had wanted to fly at the beginning of the war. That included me, of course. And I was able to go to Fargo on Salisbury Plain and was interviewed there for the glider pilot regiment. The interview was a pretty tough effort, I might tell you. Major Royal, who was running the selection board, was a regular soldier and a really tough gentleman. He had us running about with fixed bayonets and in the dark for the best part of 6 weeks, going through all the tests that obviously indicated what kind of types he was dealing with. And I was a bit lucky. I was included in those who were accepted for the regiment. If I remember rightly, there were 10 or 11 of us out of 69 on the course. The other 50-odd fell out or were chucked out. I was selected for flying training and posted from there to a Buka aerodrome and did 20 hours on Tiger Moths before I was able to fly solo. That was the absolute limit. It was, I think, 19 hours and 10 minutes or something like that. 20 hours would have meant return to unit because they give you up at 20 hours. I don't think it was because my flying was all that bad, but I did one or two stupid things, you know. For instance, I got the wrong helmet on one occasion and didn't notice that when I fastened the straps of the helmet, my ears were shut off and I couldn't hear the instructor through the pitot tube and just sat there dim whilst he flew round and round trying to tell me what to do. That didn't please him. However, I got through in the end. I was able to go solo, which I think is one of the most wonderful things that can happen to anybody. The people who fly are special people, you know, simply because once you've done the solo landing, you realize that you've come down into danger, or you've come out of danger, more by the help of God than by any of your own efforts. And you can't help feeling grateful for that, I reckon, every time. That applies to powered aircraft, making ordinary ups and downs and circuits and bumps and landing on runways. You can imagine how it applies to glider pilots when they land in battle. My first operational station was at Blake Hill Farm near Fairford. And I think mainly because I had battle experience. I was included in the party being trained for the D-Day landings on the bridges at Cannes. There must have been 30 or 40 of us in the group from E Squadron who were there. And I was crewed with Captain Boyd, who was the intelligence officer. And we did quite a lot of night flying and the kind of flying which more or less got us ready for the kind of landing which was being planned. None of us knew anything about the plans. Although I dare say Captain Boyd, or Blubber, as we used to call him, was fairly well genned up with most of the ideas that were passing through the heads of the high command. We weren't selected in the end. They picked 12 pilots for the bridges, and the rest of us missed D-Day altogether. The glory which followed D-Day for the regiment, of course, was shared by all because it made us a tremendous name. The landings with the 6th Airborne in behind the main beaches, which were more or less covered by the airborne landing for the main part of the assault, got the regiment a very good name, got 6th Airborne a good name, and got airborne generally a good name. So anybody with a web berry wandering about in London was looked upon with a certain amount of respect, I might tell you. I don't know what happened to Captain Boyd, but I think there must have been an upset of some kind, because after D-Day, he lost a pip. He became Lieutenant Boyd. And at the same time, he was a magnificent soldier. He was a regular soldier. He'd been in the Army Air Corps before he joined the regiment. He knew more about artillery spotting and all that kind of thing than any of the other officers. He didn't have an awful lot of time for the other officers, most of whom were, you know, hostilities-only types. And perhaps he'd made himself a bit unpopular somehow. But he dropped to lieutenant, and he and I went to Arnhem together 4 or 5 months after D-Day. And he went into the bag as a lieutenant. It didn't make a lot of difference to him, as it happened, because shortly after being taken prisoner, he was put on a train intending to go to Germany, intending to be sent to Germany, and he was able to jump off and join the Dutch resistance and spent the rest of the war in somebody's, what do they call the chalets on the Rhine? Schloss.
A castle
on the Rhine. I haven't heard a thing about Blubber Boyd since. Nobody seems to have heard of him. So I think perhaps he must have got himself fixed up with one of the Dutch people. The Arnhem operation, so far as I was concerned, was largely a matter of being a sergeant in charge of the patrols being sent out from the brigade headquarters around Hartenstein at Tell. I had no success with my patrols. None of them achieved anything like the kind of objectives we were hoping for. We were ambushed at every time. On the first one, I was hit on the foot, knocked the heel off my boot, and I had to spend the rest of the operation wearing plimsolls. There weren't any stores about, of course. Worst effort came from an 88 millimeter shell, which plumped into the base of a tree behind which I had taken cover and failed to explode. I might tell you that was almost as frightening as if the thing had blown me to bits. I was a bit lucky because a tornado, the first time I'd seen it happen, came over and destroyed the tank, more or less within seconds of that happening. He flew down out the sky with rockets and knocked his tank out. That was the kind of thing we were finding very, very difficult, of course, because we hadn't expected to confront or to be confronted by armor at all. The tanks kept turning up and people kept on saying, there's a tank down there. And somebody would always say, Carling, you'd better take a patrol down and see if you can find that tank. Which, as I say, I never really had an awful lot of success on the patrols. I lost a couple of my best friends. One of the people I'm thinking of at the moment had a miraculous escape. He was hit in the chest, and when I looked at him, he looked very dead because he had a tremendous great wound in his back. It looked as though something had come in the front and gone out the back. It transpired that the bullet had gone round his rib cage and ripped a tremendous amount of flesh away whilst it ricocheted around inside him. He was another one who rolled off the train. This drill we'd been taught about escaping came in very useful. When you're on a prisoner of war train, obviously the thing isn't given high priority. It's not heavily guarded as a rule. The people who were looking after our prisoners must have been a bit on the dim side because quite a lot of our chaps escaped and came back through the underground. You may have read the Grey Goose book. That fella went back, of course, to try and sort people out, and there were people spread out all over the place. Jerry hadn't had really an awful lot of time to start looking for people when the 30 Corps people eventually reached the river. Of course, they pulled back and left our chaps lying around. Quite a lot of them were lying around wounded. On the last occasion when I was hit, a mortar bomb dropped right at my feet, more or less, and threw me about 5 or 6 yards backwards.